This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, I'm Ted Weil. Thanks for joining me today, and welcome back to All About History, a quarterly periodical from Great Britain. So let's dive in. We're starting today in the middle of an article we started last week about the history of zoos. Away from viewing animals as a source of violent entertainment and a way to assert dominance and control over the natural world, the displaying of animals as a visual representation of power was a key motivation for their procurement. As a status symbol, animals were often gifted and traded on occasions of political diplomacy and international relations. In 1487, such a gift was presented to Lorenzo de' Medici, the Italian statesman who presided over the cultural, political, and economic affairs of the Republic of Florence. The Egyptian Sultan Al-Ashfrey Qaitbay arranged for a giraffe to be brought to Florence for Lorenzo as a gift to ensure the maintenance of the Egyptian relationship with the Florentines who traded in Cairo. Although the Medici family were no strangers to the acquisition of wild animals, the noble family's menagerie included a lion house, the giraffe proved to be an impressive sight for the people of Florence, particularly as the last giraffe in Italy had been during the reign of Julius Caesar. The Medici giraffe was not kept locked away, but was available for all to see as a physical representation of the Medici prestige. Cowie describes how it wandered the streets of Florence, stealing apples from the local peasants. Proof of the giraffe's existence and the impact it had on the city-state is evident in its description throughout the art of Renaissance Florence, despite the animal only having lived for a couple of years. One of the most impressive royal menageries of the medieval period was the one at the Tower of London. Established in 1235 under the reign of King Henry III, 1207 to 1272, this menagerie was the first of its kind in England and began with a gift of three big cats given to the king by the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III. There is some debate over whether these cats were lions or leopards, but nevertheless they were housed in the tower, soon to be joined by an array of exotic animals that were received by the royal family over the years. An elephant joined the menagerie in 1255, a gift from the King of France, but sadly it only survived for a couple of years, possibly because its keepers fed it with wine. Although the animals were cared for to the best of the keeper's abilities, the cramped conditions and lack of knowledge about the animals meant many of the menagerie's beasts had limited lifespans. Alongside the lions, leopards, lynxes, and baboons that made up the menagerie's collection, one of the most unusual occupants was a white bear given to Henry III in 1252 by King Hakon of Norway. Most historians have come to the conclusion that this particular bear was, in fact, a polar bear, and it became a hit with the population of London, who had gotten used to the sight of big cats at the tower. The polar bear proved to be a challenge for the sheriffs employed as its keepers, particularly as King Henry decreed that the bear must be allowed to feed itself. A muzzle was made for the bear, and a chain was provided so that the creature could be walked from the tower down to the River Thames on a daily basis. There it would be allowed to swim in the water and look for fish, all the time attached to a rope that was held by a presumably very brave and very nervous handler. The spectacle was hugely popular with the London crowds, who would never have seen anything of the kind before. Again, while these animals served to entertain the visitors who came to gawk at them, they were primarily to show the power of the crown. As a result, the care of the animals was a secondary concern, and there were occasions where not only the exotic creatures suffered, but visitors and keepers were maimed or killed by the tower's wild inhabitants. These early royal menageries were not solely a European phenomenon. When the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes arrived in Tenochtitlan, now Mexico City, in 1519, he reported that the Aztec emperor Moctezuma II had a staff of around 300 people who cared for the animals in his menagerie, which included eagles, jaguars, pumas, and wolves. Cowie also highlights that the Ottomans kept large menageries in Istanbul, while many Indian princes kept exotic beasts for combat and display. As the centuries passed, imperial expansion and advancements in transport meant that exotic animals became much more accessible. Zoological gardens, later abbreviated to zoos, emerged at the turn of the 19th century and represented a shift from the private menageries of the early modern period to the public institutions we have today, explains Cowie. This shift began in 1793, when French revolutionaries transferred the surviving animals from Louis XVI's menagerie at Versailles to a new national menagerie in the Parisian Jardin des Plantes. It was consolidated in 1828 with the establishment of the Gardens of the Zoological Society of London, the future London Zoo, and the emergence of zoological gardens in other European cities, including Dublin in 1831, Bristol in 1835, Antwerp in 1843, and Berlin 1844. When the Jardin des Plantes was created out of the necessity to remove the animals once owned by the French king as a physical representation of the monarchy's loss of power, the zoological gardens in London are commonly cited as the first to be born out of scientific intentions. Yet while the Zoological Society's establishment is more of a zoo as we understand them today, collecting animals for scientific purposes actually dates back as far as ancient Greece. At the Lyceum in Athens, the Peripatetic School was established by the philosopher Aristotle in around 335 BCE. Here, as well as teaching, Aristotle would research and write on a number of subjects, including botany, biology, zoology, and natural history. Alexander the Great, who ruled in Athens after it had been taken over by Macedonia, is said to have supplied Aristotle with a number of exotic animals, which were housed in the school's menagerie. Aristotle was able to study these creatures, their habitats, behaviors, territories, cycles, and anatomy. Though many of the animals in the Lyceum's menagerie probably did not survive long and were kept primarily for anatomical research purposes and observation rather than conservation, Aristotle's endeavors to understand the animals in his collection can be seen as one of the earliest examples of a zoo dedicated to the study of zoology. If we look even further back in time, to ancient China, the Garden of Intelligence was created by Emperor Wen Wang in around 1060 BCE. Spread over 1,500 acres, it housed animals such as deer, fish, and birds. Although there is not much known about the garden, and while the creatures kept there appear to have been less exotic than in some of the other menageries from history, the name of the collection suggests that there was some element of study intended to be undertaken by the people who visited. With the advent of the Age of Enlightenment, a period of time in the 17th and 18th century where scientific endeavor was prized in European society, people were motivated to understand more about the natural world around them, and thus zoos became a center of learning for naturalists and scientists. Most 19th century zoos embraced scientific goals in order to distinguish themselves from earlier menageries, explains Cowie. In contrast to menageries, zoos stress the educational value of their collections, the superior living conditions accorded to their animals, and the scope they provided for scientific research. Mortality rates were very high, however, and many animals perished from disease, starvation, or injuries sustained during capture. Writing in 1872, naturalist Frank Buckland estimated that out of every 6 or 7 rhinoceroses caught in a pitfall in Malacca, only one was uninjured and in a condition to be sent to Europe. However, as zoological study advanced, looking after the captured animals became more important as they began to be valued in their own right rather than as an extension of human power. Survival rates increased gradually over the course of the 19th century as zoological knowledge and veterinary medicine improved, but ignorance of the habits and diets of some animals remained high, says Cowie. In 1848, for instance, an orangutan exhibited in the Jardin des Plantes consumed chocolate, roast meat, wine, and even liqueurs, and was put to bed between a large cat and a very shaggy dog to keep him warm at night, treatment that resulted in an early death. While naturalists were transforming zoological parks into places of scientific research and understanding, the zoo became a source of entertainment in an altogether different capacity than it had been in the age of private menageries. As zoological parks and gardens began to be opened to the general public, visitors had the opportunity to explore the world through the variety of exotic animals that were completely new to them. Alongside their scientific purpose, many zoos took advantage of their appeal to a wide audience and started to offer experiences and attractions. Some zoos offered elephant rides or taught the animals in their care to perform tricks for enraptured crowds. From the 1850s, zoos also started to promote individual animals as zoological stars, capitalizing on their celebrity status to increase profits, said Cowie. In 1850, London Zoo's first-ever hippopotamus, Obeisch, prompted a surge in visitor numbers and spawned a range of hippo-themed paraphernalia, including a small statuette crafted by the sculptor Joseph Gowan, supposedly from Nile mud, a hippopotamus polka composed by Louis St. Mars, and a variety of hippopotamus-inspired trinkets from silver figurines to hippo-embossed breastpins. Nearly a century later, the arrival of the first panda, Ming, at the zoo in 1938 elicited a similar reaction, inspiring panda dolls, panda jokes, children's books, nursery wallpaper, charms, bangles, cigarette cases, and brooches. Nowadays, the zoo remains a popular tourist attraction for visitors who are excited to get a glimpse of animals they are unlikely ever to see in their natural habitat. As the climate crisis worsens and more animals are added to the endangered species list, the main purpose of the modern zoological park is now conservation. Breeding programs attempt to ensure the survival of animals that may otherwise become extinct, and zoos still regularly advertise their newest inhabitants, with the birth of certain creatures often making headlines around the world. Outside of the zoo, safari parks and experiences have also soared in popularity, as people are able to travel to the natural habitats of wild creatures and observe them in their own surroundings. Though the modern zoo seems like a far cry from the private royal menageries of the past, the zoo is still a representation of human power over nature, as we try to correct some of the wrongs we have done to the natural world and influence how the animal kingdom lives, breeds, and survives. And now we've got a couple of short sidebar articles. First, Evil Ethnology, the Dark History of the Human Zoo. While zoos and menageries have long been a place where people have been able to view and study the animal kingdom, some European zoos in the 19th and 20th centuries took these ideas to an inhumane level. The human zoo became a popular attraction for people to come and view individuals from elsewhere in the world, primarily Africa and Asia. These poor people were taken from their homes and transported across the globe to be placed in ethnological exhibitions, where they were displayed to crowds and kept captive in manufactured surroundings that were said to mimic their authentic living situations. The narrative of these indigenous people as savages was perpetuated in these settings, and they were seen as comparable to the animals kept in similar enclosures. The exhibitions held at the zoos were often temporary and provided an extra attraction to draw in the crowds. World fairs were also often home to these ethnological exhibitions, where indigenous people were made to put on displays to entertain the Western attendees. Sometimes people were displayed in cages, and it wasn't uncommon for them to die from disease or from cold. One of the most infamous examples of the displaying of humans in a zoo is from 1906, when Otabenga, a Congolese man, was kept in a cage with chimpanzees and apes at the Bronx Zoo in New York. He was labeled as the missing link, implying that he was closer to apes than people. The zoo faced some backlash at the time, and the exhibition was quickly closed. Benga, however, remained at the zoo. And now, the evolution of the zoo. Helen Cowie questions whether the ethos of the modern zoo has improved since they first opened. Quote, on the face of it, modern zoos have evolved significantly from the first zoos that were open to the public. Zoos no longer take animals from the wild, but generally secure them through breeding or exchanges with other zoos, putting an end to the environmental destruction associated with the wild animal trade. Most have embraced the rhetoric of conservation, contributing to international breeding programs and giving some of their profits to wildlife protection initiatives overseas. Animal husbandry has also improved considerably since the 19th century, with better nutrition, larger enclosures, and better veterinary care, resulting in longer life expectancy for zoo animals. While there have certainly been significant changes in the exhibition of exotic animals, however, the continuities across time are perhaps equally striking and offer some important caveats to the improvement narrative. First, despite a shift in emphasis, zoos continued to exert power over animals, and some species, especially pandas, still function as diplomatic gifts. Second, while the range of animals on display has increased over the centuries, audiences continue to gravitate toward a few charismatic mammals, with the result that many modern zoos still stock them for entertainment purposes. Elephants, great apes, and big cats have almost always been popular, while reptiles and birds have generally drawn fewer crowds. Third, though staged animal performances may have fallen out of fashion in the 20th century, the desire to see zoo animals being active or to interact with them in some way has not abated, as evidenced by the continued popularity of sea lion displays, feeding exhibitions, and immersive enclosures where visitors can enter the habitats of selected non-aggressive animals. The chimpanzee's tea party of the early 20th century, which persisted in the London Zoo until 1972, was, in many ways, a sanitized version of feeding time at the Tower Menagerie in the 17th century, when, according to the diarist Samuel Pepys, visitors could gain free entry if they brought along a live dog or cat to feed to the lions. Although the official ethos of the zoo has changed, some elements of animal display remain the same. And now we move on to another featured article, this one, Ancient Demons. From the earliest times, people have thought evil powers haunted the world and inflicted harm. Where did these beliefs come from? This article is written by Ben Gazur. Demons are everywhere. That, at least, is the impression one gets from watching any of the many horror films that fill cinemas. Whether they're killing with a smile, dragging people to hell, or challenging exorcists to get rid of them, they seem to be inescapable. Yet the idea that demons infest our world is not a new one. For millennia, people have seen malevolent spirits as the cause of illness, bad luck, and madness. What were the first demons? Before searching for the history of demons, we need to define them. Despite the best efforts of demonologists, there have been few reliable sightings of demons, and so no scientific study is possible. To study demons is to study people's belief in demons. Demons can be loosely categorized as supernatural beings with evil intentions toward humanity. The first demons will never be known by name to us. Hints of belief in the spirits can be found in cave art dating to tens of thousands of years ago. Therianthrope images, ones which blend humans and animals, have been found in widely disparate locations. In the cave of Les Trois Frères in France, there are paintings of humans with deer antlers and tails, or bull's horns and faces. A painting in an Indonesian cave known as Liang Bulo Sipong 4 shows humans hunting various animals, but the humans have the features of dogs, pigs, and birds. Analysis of uranium deposits on top of the painting has dated it to around 44,000 years old. The most famous therianthrope figure from prehistory is the Lion Man statue from Germany. Carved from a piece of mammoth ivory with flint tools, it is the oldest known human statue in the world and has been dated to around 40,000 years old. Intriguingly, this human is shown with the head of a lion. What these zoomorphic images meant to the people who created them is hotly debated and will perhaps never be settled. It does show, however, that our ancestors could imagine beings that were beyond what could be seen with their own eyes. Transgression between the realms of animal and human would often be seen in demons in later times, and many were described as having bestial features. The first written records that we possess that discuss religion come from the Mesopotamian societies. The Sumerians developed their system of cuneiform writing around 3400 BCE. It persisted for thousands of years and was adopted by the later Babylonians and Assyrians. The texts that have come down to us record the rich mythology of their cultures and the supernatural boogeymen who inhabited their world. The vast Mesopotamian pantheon featured many deities as well as lesser supernatural beings. Because their gods were anthropomorphic, they could act in petty and violent ways, just like humans. An angry god is often indistinguishable from a demon. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the goddess Ishtar visits terrible punishments on her lovers who disappoint her. When Gilgamesh refuses her advances, she sends the demonic bull of heaven to ravage the land. There were truly malevolent beings in the Mesopotamian conception of the world. Amulets show the female demon Lamashtu with a lion's head, clutching snakes and suckling a wolf and a dog. Lamashtu was particularly feared by women in childbirth, as she had a fondness for eating babies. Texts describe her sniffing out the homes that held children inside. Prayers and incantations that were used to ward off this personification of childhood mortality have been found that invoke the hideous god Panzuzu to drive her off. Many amulets with his face have been found, suggesting he was a major protector against demons. Other Mesopotamian demons include the children of the goddess Tiamat. She birthed scorpion men, dragons, monstrous snakes, and a hybrid of a snake, lion, and bird. We are told that instead of blood, these monsters were filled with venom. The demon Asag was apparently so ugly that his presence caused rivers to boil, and from his union with the mountains, he produced a race of rock demons. A large number of works survive that give instructions to priests and exorcists on how to drive out demons and evil spirits from a person. One method was to take a model of the demon that was attacking you and place it in a toy boat with items that might tempt the demon. This boat was then set afloat on a river, and as the figure was whisked away on the current, so the demon would be carried off. Much of later thinking about demons would be dominated by developing methods to free mortals from their grasp. Demons in the religion of the ancient Egyptians were most often found in the afterlife. While demons could cause harm to the living, it was the threat they posed to the dead that concerned most Egyptians. The coffin texts, found written inside coffins in ancient Egypt, consist of spells intended for the use of the deceased. The Book of Two Ways describes the path a soul must take through the afterlife. At various points, demons guard gates, and they can only be mollified by the proper recitation of spells. Should the soul fail to give the proper incantation, they will be blocked from moving on. These demons have names like Dogface, She of the Knife, or He Whose Face is Dreadful. Many of the depictions of Egyptian demons show them as anthropomorphic, but with the heads of animals, which is similar to the way major gods were shown. The form of the demons was sometimes key to their role. Those with snake heads were sneaky as they tried to tempt souls. Those with baboon aspects were cleverer and sat in judgment of the dead. The classical word demon is derived from the Greek word daemon. While demon has only negative connotations in English, the original Greek word represented a potentially more positive spirit. Socrates believed he had a daemonion, or a divine spirit, that gave him warnings if he was about to do something wrong. Homer separates the major deities, or theoi, from the lesser divine beings, or daemons. Greeks did have an idea of demons that is more similar to modern definitions, though they were not more impersonal. The poet Hesiod's Theogony, which describes how the gods came into being, tells of how the goddess Nyx, or Night, gave birth to various evil spirits. She brings forth doom, fate, blame, old age, and strife. Strife then gave birth to toil, murder, famine, and other terrible things that afflict humanity. The Keres were another of the offspring of Nyx, and represented violent deaths. Although they could not bring about death themselves, they waited for a person to die before diving down on them and using their sharp claws to tear the soul from the body and feast on the blood. The souls were carried into the underworld by the Keres before they rushed back to Earth to eat again. If in our definition of demons we do not include the various monsters of Greek and Roman myth that could be slain, such as the many beasts faced by Heracles, there are still plenty of demonic characters left. For example, the Furies, or Erinyes, were ancient divinities born from the blood dropped from the castrated genitalia of Uranus. There they are described in different ways, but all of them horrible. They were variously said to have the wings of a bat, snakes for hair, or the heads of dogs. Yet even here their role was ambiguous. They tormented humans, but not any and all humans. The Furies relentlessly pursued people who had broken an oath or killed a parent. In other words, people who had broken the laws of the gods. If the classical world was ambivalent about demons, the Abrahamic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam had and still have a more certain role for them. Where pantheistic faiths have many gods, it's easy to fit demons into a scheme of the universe. But those who follow a monotheistic religion with one all-good God, find it harder to explain why there is evil at all, let alone beings of evil. The Jewish Bible, which forms the Christian Old Testament, has few mentions of demons. In the Hebrew, where there are beings called Shedim and Serim, where the Bible was translated into Greek, Shedim was translated as daemon, giving us our modern term for demons. These terms were often used for foreign gods, to which foolish people were said to sacrifice their children. The Book of Leviticus states that offering a child to Moloch, a god or demon depending on your faith, is an abomination. The idea that gods other than one's own were demons would have a long history. In the rich collections of Jewish wisdom and folklore, demons play a much stronger role. Lilith, who is mentioned only once in the Bible, evolved into a powerful female demon. Bowls with incantations against Lilith have been found in Mesopotamia, and it seems that Lilith developed out of figures common in Mesopotamian belief. In later tradition, Lilith was the first wife of Adam, but quarreled with the first man over who would be on top during sexual intercourse. Lilith abandoned Adam and now roams the world, seducing men to steal their seed to give birth to more demons. Other demons can be found in Jewish texts. Asmodeus features in the Book of Tobit, where he is described as the worst of demons. In other texts, he struggles with King David and would later be brought into Christian belief. And that, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining me for this journey through All About History. I hope you'll meet me here again next week, and we'll pick up right where we left off and then explore some more exciting articles from our past. I'm Ted Weil, wishing you all the best. Until next time.